we really can't get into the hiring process. That stuff is kept confidential.
The state defends hiring a ferry security officer with a checkered work history. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 11th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the state identifies gaps in safety net health care services.
The majority are people with a chronic condition that require specialty care, and there's no service available to them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A former Haines police officer with a questionable work history was recently hired by the state for a high-level security position, but the state is not releasing much information about the hiring process or what it knew about the man's past. From member station KHNS, Margaret Friedenauer reports.
Jason Joel was hired in May as the security officer for the Alaska Marine Highway System. He is the incident commander for the state ferry system in the case of a major security event. He has supervision over vessel and facility security officers. He works with the Coast Guard, Customs and Immigration, and national, state, and local law enforcement agencies. In the last 26 years, Joel worked as a police officer in several departments in Florida and Alaska. He held many of those jobs less than a year. In at least three cases, he agreed to resign in exchange for the department's keeping any details of his work and conduct confidential from the public and future employers. Joel started at the Haines Police Department in 2006 and was promoted to sergeant after 3 years. A few months later, he was demoted. Police chief at the time, Gary Lowe, wouldn't give a reason for the demotion. Joel's personnel file with the Haines Borough is confidential. The borough will only confirm it struck a deal with Joel in exchange for his resignation. Several Haines residents confirmed to KHNS News they witnessed or experienced instances of Joel verbally harassing women, although none wanted their name used in this report. A former police dispatcher documented several instances of harassment from Joel while on the job. She said she reported the incidents to the chief. Several months after Joel left Haines, the Alaska Police Standards Council confirmed it was investigating him. In 2012, the council said it was moving ahead with a process to revoke his police certification. At that point, Joel voluntarily surrendered his certification, meaning he cannot work as a police officer anywhere in the state. It's not clear if the state asked about Joel's certification during a background check.
We really can't get into the hiring process. That stuff is kept confidential.
Jeremy Woodrow is spokesperson for the Department of Transportation.
So really what we can just comment on is that he met the qualifications for the position and that he's accepted it and that he's actually already started working for the Marine Highway System.
Woodrow says police certification isn't a qualification for the job.
He doesn't need a APSC certification to perform the duties as a security officer for the Marine Highway System.
Woodrow also says the state cannot reveal how many applicants it had for the security officer job. Aside from his work history, public records also show Joel filed for bankruptcy twice in 15 years. The first bankruptcy was in Florida in 1999, and few details are available. But his 2012 bankruptcy case details nearly $80,000 in debt, not including a mortgage. Joel owes one Haines business, Lutac Lumber, more than $8,000. Owner Chip Lendy says he doesn't extend that line of credit to just anyone, but Joel held a prominent position in the community.
And an individual that I think has been bestowed public trust because of the position they've been hired for, we don't expect them to abuse that when they come into the store and look for credit. We think that they're an honorable, trustworthy person because they've been hired under that pretense. So when that trust is abused, it's a double slap in the face, not just to the vendor, but to the community, because we've extended that credit based on our perceived relationship with the community for this person.
Because the state's hiring process is confidential, the public has no way of knowing exactly what the state knew about Joel before he became a state employee. Joel did not respond to requests for comment. Reporting from Haines, I'm Margaret Friedenauer.
The ground-based missile defense system, which includes interceptors at Fort Greely, failed at target practice over the Pacific last year. Now the Pentagon is asking Congress for money to overhaul the system. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the budget request shows Alaska is likely to remain central to missile defense as the system matures.
Missile Defense Agency Director James Searing told senators they don't need to worry about a repeat of last year's botched test when an interceptor launched from California missed because the head failed to separate from the booster.
The failure last July, I won't go into details in this forum, but it was very simple. And I'm confident that we've corrected that.
The Missile Defense Agency is asking Congress for $7.5 billion for next year. Searing says one crucial element is a new detection system called LRDR, Long-Range Discrimination Radar, which is likely to be based in Alaska. Searing told a Senate committee he wants to have the billion-dollar radar operating within 6 years.
The importance of the radar is that it provides us that needed discrimination capability against the threat from North Korea. As they continue to progress and add decoys and countermeasures, and I'll stop there in terms of classification, we must have a discrimination capability of a radar to counter that.
Searing says he hopes to announce a location in a few months, but the agency has already told potential contractors to assume the radar will be installed at Clear Air Force Station near Fairbanks. The budget also calls for 14 more interceptors at Fort Greely, bringing the total there to 40 by mid-2017. One part of Alaska the Missile Defense Agency is giving up on is Kodiak. The agency used to launch rockets from there to serve as targets, but stopped in 2010 in favor of Kwajalein Atoll in the Pacific. Senator Lisa Murkowski asked if the Kodiak launch facility might be part of a future test. Searing said no, because the testing has to be more realistic now, and the geometry of a launch from Kodiak makes it a poor stand-in for North Korea. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The U.S. Air Force is expected to slow down the demolition slated for Gakona's HAARP facility. Today, Air Force Research Lab Public Affairs Representative Charles Gulick emailed APRN saying Air Force leadership is currently considering the option of deferring the dismantling for up to 10 months to allow time for a potential transfer to another entity. University of Alaska Fairbanks has conducted research programs at the HAARP for many years. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, preparing for the cultural event called Celebration in Juneau.
How powerful it is to watch them be immersed in the culture, in the language. It's beautiful.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Finding the time for physical activity after school, homework, and dinner can be tough, but you can make it a priority to stay healthy as a family. Go for a bike ride, take a walk around the neighborhood, or play a game of basketball with your kids. Get active, get moving, and have fun as a family. Inspire your kids to get out and play 60 minutes every day. For more ways to get physically active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The health of the Bristol Bay watershed and its salmon fishery is an issue of statewide importance. That's the position the state of Alaska took today when defending its decision to certify a citizens' initiative that would add another obstacle to the development of the Pebble Mine. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Assistant Attorney General Libby Bacalar presented the state's case before the Alaska Supreme Court.
The mineral deposits and fisheries in the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve belong to all Alaskans. They don't just belong to or impact the people living in that region.
The Alaska Miners Association and the Council of Alaska Producers are behind the lawsuit. Their goal is to remove the Bristol Bay Forever initiative from the November ballot. That measure would require the legislature to sign off on large-scale mining operations in the region, and it would add another layer of scrutiny to the proposed Pebble Mine beyond the permitting process. The miner's attorney, Matt Singer, argued that because the initiative only focuses on Bristol Bay instead of mining operations throughout the state, it is unconstitutional.
We don't regulate land and environmental decisions by balkanizing those decisions, by regionalizing those decisions, unless we're seeking to solve a problem that cannot be addressed by a general law.
On that point, Justice Craig Stowers pushed back on Singer.
My question is, you know, if we have statewide interest in the minerals and fisheries and this world-class watershed and this world-class fishery, isn't that enough in terms of establishing general applicability or a general interest or a statewide interest, putting aside the purpose statement of the initiative?
The lawsuit was filed shortly after the state certified the Bristol Bay Forever Initiative in 2012 and has stretched on for about a year and a half. The Fairbanks Superior Court sided with the state on the matter in February, and the Supreme Court justices would have to reverse that ruling for the measure to be taken off the ballot. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The Alaska Judicial Council has released its recommendations for retention of state, district, and Superior Court judges. The judges will come up for vote on the November ballot. Suzanne DiPietro, executive director of the council, says 13 of the 14 state judges have been given the thumbs up, but one judge, William Estelle, who sits on the bench in Palmer, has not gained Judicial Council approval.
Judge Estelle filed 16 untrue affidavits under oath from September 2011 through February 2013, swearing that he had completed or issued decisions in all matters that had been pending before him for more than 6 months, when in fact he had not completed those decisions. Judge Estelle continued to receive his salary on time, and that's contrary to a state law that prohibits a judge from being paid on time if the judge has undecided matters outstanding for longer than 6 months.
The Judicial Council concluded that by filing untrue affidavits, Judge Estelle failed to conduct himself in a manner that promotes public confidence in the judiciary. Judge Estelle was appointed in 2003. He has been approved in two previous retention elections, in 2006 and in 2010. In April of this year, the Commission on Judicial Conduct filed formal charges against Judge Estelle and, after a hearing, issued its findings and recommendations. DiPietro says that only state judicial district 3 voters will have an opportunity to vote for or against Judge Estelle. District 3 encompasses South Central Alaska and Kodiak Island. When Governor Sean Parnell decided to reject federal Medicaid expansion last fall, he asked for a study detailing the safety net services available to low-income Alaskans. That report is out this week, and it shows 12,000 Alaskans have no reliable access to health care, particularly specialty care. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The report shows basic health care, like a primary care doctor's visit, is generally accessible, even to low-income, uninsured patients. Community health centers, like the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, provide services on a sliding fee scale. The report was prepared by the Department of Health and Social Services. Commissioner Bill Struer says there are 200 locations across the state that offer basic health care to low-income Alaskans.
The range of preventive services, the range of primary care services, the options for those folks are pretty significant.
But Struer acknowledges many low-income and uninsured Alaskans have more complicated medical needs. When that's the case, they may find help through a patchwork system of charity care. Those options include hospital emergency rooms and Project Access, which connects uninsured residents to specialists willing to waive their fees. Struer says his department is trying to figure out how many uninsured Alaskans need regular access to specialty care.
The majority are people with a chronic condition or an acute condition that requires specialty care, and there's no service available to them.
The report also identifies outpatient mental health care as an area that may not be available to the uninsured. The department doesn't make recommendations for addressing the overall gap in access. Struer says that will be the job of the Medicaid Reform Advisory Group that started meeting this spring.
What could we do under Medicaid? What could we do under other initiatives to be able to fill this gap.
Alaskans who fall into the gap generally are childless adults who have incomes under $15,000 a year. They aren't eligible for subsidies to buy insurance under the Affordable Care Act because the law assumed they would qualify for Medicaid instead. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Despite precarious ice conditions, local responders in Shishmaref are working to absorb the oily sheen discovered off the island's north coast last week. The source of the substance remains unknown. KNOM's Anna Rose MacArthur has more.
Richard Kuzik is with the Shishmaref Environmental Program. He says residents can smell the gasoline-like odor from the sheen throughout the community.
You can smell the odor, the native store, Walter store, which is 3/4 of the village length as far as the houses.
Last Thursday, Shishmaref's Village Public Safety Officer reported a sheen on the nearshore ice pack to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. The next day, a team from the DEC, the Coast Guard, and Spill Response Coordinator, Emerald Alaska, arrived on the island to investigate.
It looked to us to be some type of weathered petroleum product, such as a gasoline or a diesel.
Paul Lotka is an environmental program specialist with the DEC. He says no source has been identified and no volume estimation of the product has been calculated. However, a situation report estimates the sheen covers a 1,200-foot area of nearshore ice. U.S. Coast Guard Chief Eric Vogel with the Incident Management Division at Sector Anchorage says this ice is hindering cleanup efforts. Local responders are maintaining absorbency boom and pads along the coast of the affected area to soak up and confine the substance. But with the ice and breakup, responders cannot venture more than 5 feet offshore by foot or skiff.
Responders unable to work out on the ice, so much of the recovery operations was from shore. This is absorbent boom and pads that are anchored to the shore with rebar and passively collecting this emulsified oil.
DEC's Lotka says the ice is thawing at a rapid rate and should melt in a few days. No known wildlife impacts have resulted from the sheen. Samples of the oily substance are being shipped to the U.S. Coast Guard Marine Safety Lab in Connecticut. They are being compared to petroleum samples from the Shishmaref tank farm. Coast Guard personnel are returning to Shishmaref this Friday to continue their investigation. In Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
John Davies came to Alaska in 1967 to study geophysics and climb mountains. 25 years later, he was making laws in the legislature. Along the way, he's faced floods, volcanic eruptions, and a battle over state income taxes, learning a lot about the tectonic plates and the people who have shaped Alaska. Molly Reddig talked to John Davies for this series about life in Fairbanks before the pipeline boom.
John Davies spent his first summer in Fairbanks on the Upper Chena River, using satellite dishes to record radio emissions from the sun. On August 11th, it rained 3.5 inches.
It was just raining like crazy, and the water was coming up.
At 11 a.m., his partner called from the research site a quarter mile away, stranded by floodwater. John jumped in the only available vehicle, a front-end loader, to go rescue him.
The water was over the tires. It was 6 feet deep. Unfortunately, in our bunkhouse area, it was high and dry, but there was water everywhere around us.
The Great Flood of 67 nailed Fairbanks the next day, flooding the power plant, wiping out the hospital, and displacing 8,000 people. The bridges washed out, and two grad students were stuck there for weeks. Luckily, they had a generator, an electric oven, and all the ingredients for cake. The next day was the caretaker's birthday.
And then we made a raft out of oil drums, and we pulled across, you know, this flooded area so we could get over to their place, and we delivered this birthday cake to her.
Then came the first winter.
50 below seemed like I was on the other side of the moon, you know. I mean, it really seemed just a complete different thing.
That's John's wife, Linda Schandelmeyer, laughing. She moved up the same year from a homestead in Anchorage. She says the ice fog was way worse than it is today, thanks to lower temperatures and dirtier car engines.
You'd be at an intersection, and you could barely see that the lights were red. I mean, you stop. And then it was like, when they turned green, it was like, you just had to go on a wing and a prayer. It's like, I guess I'll turn left, but I hope nobody else is out there. I mean, because you really couldn't tell.
John had summit fever. In 1970, he attempted a first ascent of Mount Kimball in the Alaska Range, skiing 40 miles in on the Canwell Glacier. But when they reached the final steep, icy pitch, they ran out of ice screws. They were climbing back down, roped together, when one member of his group vanished.
It was a fairly narrow crevasse, and you know, the sound doesn't travel very far, and we were concerned that he was unconscious.
His friend was uninjured when they pulled him 50 feet up and over the lip of the crevasse, but it was the last peak John tried to bag. Field work was an adventure too, especially before GPS and satellite phones. Linda spent one summer living in a wall tent near Bristol Bay studying cormorants. Once a month, someone from Bethel would fly out to check on her.
Essentially, we had no communication. They wouldn't let you do that now. I mean, are you kidding? What if you got hurt? The nearest village was like 25 miles away.
John spent many summers installing seismic stations in the Aleutians, cruising around islands in a fishing boat and climbing craggy hillsides.
I mean, you first look at it and you think it's just a godforsaken patch of grass out there in the middle of the ocean, and it's just cold and windy, and it is a lot of the time. But it's also just an enormously beautiful place and very, very rich in sea life.
One time he hitched a ride with a fishing boat from Sand Point to Nagai Island. When the cannery called to say they desperately needed product, John ended up spraying shrimp with a fire hose all day rather than setting up seismometers.
And we fished for about, I don't know, 10 or 12 hours, and we caught over 100,000 pounds of shrimp. You know, that is a lot of frigging shrimp. The guy who was sort of the chef, you know, fried up some of the shrimp for us. These are almost like prawns. They were really good.
In 1993, he headed for the next summit, the state legislature. Alaska's oil revenues were cut in half that decade as oil prices and production dropped. John, a House Democrat, proposed a state income tax to balance the budget.
It was a crazy tax, you know, but it had the advantage that that it was deductible on people's federal income taxes. So it would actually save people in Alaska about $100 million, you know, over the course of a year.
It passed the House but was crucified in the Republican-controlled Senate. Then his opponent used it to beat him in the next election.
They ran an ad with a woman in their kitchen looking in her checkbook and saying she just didn't understand why that John Davies wanted to take $3,000 away from her.
In the past 5 decades, John has learned a lot about the physics, the resources, and the people that make Alaska tick. Now he'd like to see the state invest in renewable energy for the future. Having lived here in the 60s, it's not that hard for him to imagine life in Alaska without oil. In Fairbanks, I'm Molly Reddig.
Celebration begins this evening with the grand entrance procession to Centennial Hall in Juneau. The 4-day cultural event of Southeast Alaska Natives includes 50 dance groups. Among them is All Nations Children's Dance Group of Juneau. The group formed in 1995 and has 80 members. KTOO's Scott Burton attended a recent practice and brings us this story.
It's a Thursday evening, and some 50 kids and teenagers dance their way through the Tlingit Haida Community Center near Salmon Creek. Group founder and leader Vicky Soboloff walks up and down the line giving instructions. Soboloff says she and the group have come a long way since the first practice in 1995.
There were 12 children here, and there was, you know, a group of their parents and maybe grandparents and aunts and uncles, but all those children were looking at me, and I was terrified. And we didn't start out singing Tlingit songs. We actually started out singing This Old Man. You know, I was just trying to get them to sing. And plus, I was nervous.
At this practice, they sing numerous Alaska Native songs, and Soboloff says they're instruments for learning.
Knowledge of your Native culture and involvement in Native song and dance and language really helps you with your sense of self and belonging belonging to your tribe, your clan. I believe it's really important for Native children to know who they are, where they came from, what their tribal clan is.
Okay, so do you know your Tlingit name?
Yes.
What is it?
Gujish Tla. Gujish Tla.
Gujish Tla.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to record it for you.
One of Soboloff's early dancers is now a teacher. Barbara Dude joined the group when she was 7, and now, at 26, she's an assistant group leader. Right now, she's helping 15-year-old Allison Ford with her Tlingit introduction, just like Soboloff helped her.
Allison Ford, you could do a sock. Raven or eagle?
Raven, beaver.
Deshitan?
Yes.
Yeshnach chet siti, deshitan ayachet gunashtish. That's your introduction. That's what you need to say at celebration, okay?
Among other things, Dude says she gained language skills, self-esteem, and public speaking skills. But the most important lessons were about something more. She says the group's goal to help engender identity worked.
When I started the group when I was 7, I didn't know that I was Tlingit. And so the group has really helped me gain a sense of pride in who I am. And now I'm able to share that with my children who have known they were Tlingit since they were born.
Dude is excited for celebration, especially the grand entrance.
We all dance in together, and ahead of us are dancers from another group, and behind us are dancers from another group, and we're dancing across stage, and each person gets their chance to go across stage and really dance their hardest.
She says watching the kids at celebration performances is the best part.
Because they feel it, because everyone around them is feeling it with them. How powerful it is to watch them be immersed in the culture and the language. It's beautiful. Sorry. It's beautiful.
The All Nations Children's Dance Group is true to its name and is open to children of all races and ages until high school graduation. Then Soboloff and Dude hope they'll join an adult group or stick around to help children learn language, song, dance, and especially cultural identity and pride. I'm Scott Burton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome, Molly Reddick in Fairbanks, and Scott Burton in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.